Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans.
Good morning, Steve Williamson here.
Mike Constantino, barely awake.
Barely awake, Mike Constantino. And we have joining us one of our producers of Democratic Perspective, Gary LeMaster.
Good morning.
And we're going to talk about the Supreme Court today.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of important cases before the Supreme Court. The other thing that we know that when we were listening to a lecture is people think they know more about the court than they actually do. And so Gary has some statistics, but which we have. And Gary, let's talk about it. People say I'm going to take it all the way to Supreme Court. How many attempts are there to bring a case to a Supreme Court, and how many cases they actually take?
I've actually had my testimony reviewed by the Supreme Court in the case, by the way.
And I'm sure they rejected it. But,
yeah. No, we won.
Oh, okay, okay.
But, very good.
Anyway, there's each year there's approximately 8,000 petitions or cases that people want to take to the Supreme Court, but each year only about 75 cases actually make the Supreme Court docket. The justices decide which ones they want to hear, and it takes, if I remember correctly, one justice out of the nine to get a case considered.
And then it takes four justices to guarantee that it'll be heard, right? That's
right.
Called a rule of four. What else, Gary? So there are all these cases, and what are the criteria? People think the Supreme Court has to take my case, but the Supreme Court doesn't have to take probably any cases, right? You have to convince the court that it should take your case.
The four criteria are, number one is there a substantial federal question? Is there a constitutional issue at
stake? So they don't want to decide about a drug bust, right? Whether somebody's guilty or not guilty. They want a rule of law.
Or the other
stuff is settled at a lower court level, the actual conviction.
Yeah, your trespassing case isn't going to make it to the Supreme Court. The second criteria is that is there a disagreement between the circuit courts or the appellate courts?
United States is divided into different circuit courts, and cases can be appealed from state courts and from lower federal courts to the circuit courts. And so if the circuit court in California disagrees with the circuit court, our court is based in California and San Francisco for our circuit, disagrees with another circuit, so there's a conflict of the law at a very high level, then the case tends to go to the Supreme Court.
Or it could be a conflict between state courts, state Supreme Courts. So these are all generally federal questions that are being answered at the U.S. Supreme Court. The third criteria is a request by the Solicitor General, the chief litigator, if you will, of the United States, who works for the Justice Department.
He's the government's chief trial lawyer.
Right,
one of the justices now was the Solicitor General.
That's right.
Justice Kagan.
Correct. And then the fourth one is no fact bound cases that issues that transcend individuals.
So they clearly want a case that they can decide about the law, not about the facts of the case.
Well, it's interesting. We got a branch of government that whose job it is to take seven articles of the Constitution, a preamble, seven articles and 27 amendments, and that's all they do is interpret that.
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution and the original Constitution is about 4,000 words. It's not very long. Yeah. And with all the amendments for the last two centuries, it's around 7,000 words. So there's not, people say, they carry around the Constitution, but there's not a lot of detail in the Constitution. there are fundamental ideas and stuff, and they have to be decided. There's nothing in the Constitution except saying that there should be a Supreme Court, creating a Supreme Court and creating the position of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. There's almost nothing in the Constitution about what they do, how many members they have, or anything else.
Well, you know, people like me have to admit, the Supreme Court engenders like this visceral respect, you know, for some reason. And yet, it's what as I age here and I learn more, it is somewhat an unjustified respect. It's as political a body as any that we have.
Yeah, that's another issue. In the original days, in the early days of the Republic, it wasn't much respected. Nobody took cases there. People ignored its decision. It's built up respect over generations by presenting the law in a reasonable way. But there have been, you know, there's the Dred Scott case, right? In other words, way back they say slavery is just fine.
Right.
They say for a long time the court says segregation is just fine, as long as it's separate but equal.
Well, in spite of those historical reasons, some of us believe that, you know, this cool, considered consideration of the law is by these really, really smart people is above politics, and it's simply not.
No, and the famous case is back in the Roosevelt administration, right? And the court has these four very, very far right-wing jurists. They're called the four horsemen of the apocalypse.
That's right.
And they vote against everything the New Deal stands for. And they've got two swing justices, and they vote against everything in the New Deal. So Roosevelt comes up with this reform of the Supreme Court. And the reform is that when you turn 70 years old, then he gets to appoint an additional justice. Guess how many guys are 70 years old on the court?
Yeah,
there's two of them, and then the other four of them are going to be 70 years as old within 2 years. So Roosevelt threatens the court. You're voting all the legislation that Congress is overwhelmingly voting for. You're voting for an overwhelming popular thing. And Roosevelt loses the case. He's not able to change the court, the court, if you want to call it. But the two swing justices suddenly start voting
for
the New Deal and let the New Deal legislation come through because, you know, I mean, they're going to damage the standing of the court if they stand in the way of everything.
Well, they saw their political vulnerability. Some people talk, that's now fast forward 70 years, Chief Justice Roberts.
So we get one, this is the most conservative court in generation, and we get one conservative right-wing decision after another.
Right.
And then we come to Obamacare, right, Matt?
Yeah, it's just smacks of politics.
Well, Roberts is, if you look at these guys, he's not the most conservative guy on the court. But beforehand, at first they thought there was no case really against Obamacare. That's what the professors and the lawyers thought. And they gradually developed something that looked like a stronger case against it. And the justices seemed to hear arguments that in the past they wouldn't listen to.
Uh-huh.
And so Obamacare was, or the Affordable Care Act was in jeopardy. A lot of people studying it believe that it was some of the far right members of the court who are sort of libertarian leaning that would not block it, but it turned out to be Justice Roberts, and what people think is that half the people in the country support affordable health care,
right,
and support the president, and to vote a legislation that the Congress spent 2 years on and the president was for, and that might bring into question of the court. So I think there are limits. You know, if you're on the court, you don't really want to be completely out of step with the opinion.
Well, but what happened to the cool deliberation of law? I mean, it's all subject to politics.
I mean, you had Scalia giving out Republican talking points instead of law.
So, I mean,
it was a shock.
He's talking from Republican.
He's talking from Republican talking points, from Republican points, from events that are not even happening, that have been removed from the bill. It's pretty much a scandal. I mean, well, nobody cares, I guess. Or
apparently,
well,
the interesting thing about the Obamacare case was that it was initially thought that it would be protected by the Commerce Authority of the United States, that interstate commerce, and they basically shot it down based on that, but. They, you know, when you say it's political, yes, it is. But they use the law to justify the politics.
Yeah, okay.
And so, Roberts, then surprisingly looked at the case as a tax, and so it gave the court the ability to approve it. Because it was viewed as a tax, it initially wasn't being heard on that basis. One of the other things I think, to your point, Mike, about politics is that this whole idea of there are no real rules of conflict and etiquette on the court. Justice Thomas, his wife was heavily involved in the fight against Obamacare, mm-hmm. and. Had been paid a lot of money on that in that regard.
He had attended meetings. Thomas attended any affordable health care meetings.
And yet he still didn't recuse himself, even though he had been asked by many, many people.
So a Supreme Court justice decides for themselves whether to not participate in a case.
They decide the etiquette. There's another one coming up, I believe, this session that involves Monsanto. And Thomas has got an obvious conflict because he has, I believe, been paid by Monsanto on some other instances, and he's chosen not to recuse himself from this. So it is becoming more and more political. But
there's not much you can do if a justice wants to be biased. There's not much. First, there's nothing you can prove, and there's no rules. That because they're the highest court in the land. There has to be a highest court in the land. I mean, the cases have to end somewhere, right?
Yeah. I just looked it up, and Thomas had been counsel for Monsanto. So there's an obvious basis for conflict.
So let's talk about some of the cases before the Supreme Court then, and we can talk about the politics of the cases too.
Okay.
But there's a whole bunch of important cases before the court this year. Let me mention one. So, if you hear us talk later, you think it's all big political issues of gay rights, DOMA and stuff. But here's an interesting case that's before the court. And it's called Maryland versus King. The plaintiff is the guy who's brought the case is Anthony King. He's arrested for assault in 2009. They take a DNA swab of him and they find he's committed a rape. He's convicted of rape. So the question is, they don't get a court order, they don't do anything, they just take this swab, they take his DNA without his permission. So is taking DNA like doing somebody's fingerprints, or is it, because DNA can reveal tremendous amount of personal information, is it something that requires more court order? So it's basically about the right of privacy, right, Mike? It's not something that that's a big social issue, I guess, or maybe it is.
Well, I think it is. If there's any privacy left, which many would argue doesn't exist anymore, but is your DNA now? In the law and order type say, well, look, this guy was a bad guy, he committed a rape. They found out. It doesn't matter how they found out. Well, it does matter how they found out. I mean, if law and order SVU and ignoring the Constitution. I mean, even the promos for this show talk about ignoring constitutional rights in pursuit of catching the bad guys, and that's it's a difficult position to be in, but it's not always but it's a position that the court should be in. This is good Supreme Court stuff. What side are we on here? I mean, are we on the privacy side, or can they take your DNA without?
Well, it's a legitimate question, I think, and I don't really have a strong opinion on it personally. It's how is it really any different than fingerprints?
Well, they can get your with your DNA, they can tell your parentage now. They can tell any kind of diseases you have. They can tell all kinds of stuff. Anyway, that's the argument. Now, I don't see any reason why the court couldn't limit the kind of information used. So he has a DNA match on this rape case. Maybe we don't need to know the rest of his entire genetic makeup to take him to court and try him for a rape.
It really is an interesting case because, there are some overriding social issues of finding real criminals and proving it and getting them, dangerous people off the street. And
isn't that exactly the kind of cases, Gary, that the court's supposed to decide, whether they have to balance rights versus the ability to protect the public?
Yeah. So it's going to be fascinating to see what the result.
Let's talk a little bit about the political cases, and they fall into, and Gary might have a different take on it, but I see them as falling into DOMA cases, Spencer Marriage Act cases, affirmative action cases, and voting rights cases.
Right.
And there's a political funding case that is coming up, and I forgot to print it out, but it's about how much can somebody donate to a political campaign. When you're coming on the heels of the decision that money equals free speech of a number
Citizens
of years
United,
ago.
Yeah.
Well, this was Vallejo, I believe.
Vallejo, and then it goes to Citizens United. What it would do is take out all the restraints on money as speech.
In Citizens United, just to remind you, it's the case that corporations are people. They have the rights of people, so therefore they can participate in politics just as individuals can. And now we come to this case where you would potentially remove all of the limits of political campaign funding. So if it's as expected, found in favor of removing the limits, then it's going to be fascinating.
Well, the good news with that, though, is that if it goes that way with the court, then the legislature must act.
Right. Congress has got to do something to put some controls on it.
I think we need constitutional. I think that's a good one to bring up. I'm going to talk about first a case called Fisher versus the University of Texas, and it's about affirmative action. And Fisher has sued the University of Texas, saying that she didn't get in the University of Texas because of affirmative action. And University of Texas has a rule. It takes the top 10% of graduates, but it also takes other things into account, racial factors, diversity, and so forth and so on. It's an interesting case. It is interesting that the African-American population of Texas is 12%. Their population of U of T in Austin, where the case is taking place, is 4.6%.
Why did I think we were so done with affirmative action, and yet here's a case going to the Supreme Court? I thought this was over.
Well, they don't want any affirmative action at all. See, it's not based, what I'm trying to get at, Max, is not based on the statistics, which show that there's still African Americans are underrepresented. Hispanics are represented at exactly the same percentage of the population that they are generally at the university, 20%, 20%. The big difference is Asians are represented as a small part of the population, but about 17% of the students. So that means that if you really, really, it means that despite all the affirmative action stuff that people can get in, and that, so it's not a statistical thing. I think they're not looking at, is this affecting the overall? They're looking about whether affirmative action, giving somebody a leg up because they've been discriminated or come from a poor family or whatever it is legal at all. I think that's the case. And so that's an example of a more political case that has more implications. You guys want to talk about the
so real quick? They want to eliminate any shred of a reason of giving somebody some help in a college admission for any other.
It's the argument that affirmative action is no longer necessary. Right. There's a case in Alabama. And what is that called, Gary? That's called Shelby County versus Holder. Holder's the Attorney General of the United States. Nix versus Holder. A couple of counties in Alabama are suing. And the argument is, and it's true here in Arizona, right, Mike, is that the government has to review changes in the way voting is done.
A lot of people
to
don't know
see
that,
it's done fairly. But it's not aimed at the whole country. I mean, New York didn't have any discrimination, and therefore there's no review
those
of
nine
their
states that were accused of voting rights violations. Yeah,
and one
from,
of
from
and,
Old Dixie.
Yeah. Yeah,
and Arizona's one of them.
So the argument is that the that this section, I think it's Section 5 of the Civil Rights, I can be corrected on that, the Civil Rights Act's no longer relevant because Shelby County hasn't discriminated against anybody for a long time, and they don't want to have to keep proving that they don't discriminate because it takes time and money to submit the application and say, well, you know, we're not discriminating.
And it also makes it difficult to gerrymander or pack and crack, as they talk about packing, you know, people from one group into a district, or breaking apart, minorities in a district in order to get who you want elected. So it becomes a critical case for gerrymandering.
And the president said that, you know, they're still going to be able to vote whatever decision on this. But what we see, folks, is a lot of voter suppression. So you got Democrats get the majority of votes in the House in Pennsylvania, except in the House is 2/3 Republican because of gerrymandering. And Gary mentioned, what was it, pack and cracking. Packing is putting all the minority folks in one little district. Cracking is spreading them out into so many districts they don't have any influence. We still see voter suppression. There are still active campaigns. So for some of us, that's kind of a even if this court case is not directly about that, that still voter rights are still an issue, don't you think?
Well, it was addressed in the inaugural Obama's inaugural address. So yeah, it's still a big issue. The voting in this country is a fractured mess.
Well, look what happened to all of the states that were Republican controlled during the 2012 elections, where you had all these new voter ID laws. You had in Florida they realized that minorities that African Americans tend to vote on Sundays, so they did away with Sunday voting.
Yeah. Right. So there, you know, and Jim Crow didn't spell out if you're black you can't vote. It's spelled out if your grandfather couldn't vote you can't vote.
Right.
So it's always been a little bit of a subtle thing.
What other cases we got?
Well, there's one I don't think we'll take up too much, but it's an interesting one to mention is Oklahoma versus Barber. And Oklahoma has a law saying that personhood begins with conception. And that creates a tremendous amount of problems and stuff. That's before the court. Oklahoma versus Barber. I thought we should move on to the
Does that allow the fetus to sue the mother if the mother smokes or does something?
The fetus can contribute to the Karl Rove's pack.
The fertilized egg is a human person, is the law. Supporters say the measure is critical to defining life, and opponents say it will block abortions, even in cases of rape, incest.
It makes it murder.
And when the mother's life is in
murder.
Danger, yeah. It will severely restrict the use of contraception and in vitro fertilization. So that's the case against it. There are a couple of Defense of Marriage Act cases before the court. One coming out of California, and I believe the other one's from Massachusetts.
Those are big ones, and people
are
watching
big cases.
Closely.
And so, DOMA is the Defense of Marriage Act. It was passed in 1996. It was passed with Democratic votes as well as Republican. It restricts, for the purposes of the federal government and any kind of benefits, marriages between one man and one woman. And so that's 96. Here we are in 2013. Public opinion has shifted very, very far, and is still shifting even at a rapid pace about gay marriage. It turns out, particularly among younger people, there's just no support for banning gay marriage. I mean, they're the in favor of gay marriage by about 70% now. So the worm has turned. Things are shifting, but the cases are going before the court, right, Gary?
One by one, the states are passing laws or finding that gay marriage is legal. I think one of the cases, one of the two cases, one is involves California's Prop 8. The other is a couple, a woman that was married to her gay lover or lesbian lover and of 40 years. They were married in Canada. And when her partner died, she was assessed $363,000 in estate taxes. Now, these are taxes that if she had been married to a man, or if it was a heterosexual marriage, she wouldn't have been assessed the taxes at all.
Yeah, so spouses don't have to pay tax inheritance taxes.
So this gets to the heart of the issue.
And there's
the
a physical number on the damage to her. The damage to her is $360,000 that she would have had and wouldn't. And so that's going to the court.
Right.
And what about the one on Proposition 8 defined marriage as a between one man and one woman in California? It carried, didn't carry by that much, but it did carry. I believe the local courts ruled it unconstitutional. And so now it's going to the Supreme Court, and that goes to the famous, 14th Amendment clause? Gary, what's the...
Well, it gets at the main issues that are questions that are being raised here is marriage a fundamental right? You know, is that a measure of equality for all people? If so, does it violate the 14th Amendment of equal protection? You know, if
liberty, and property is what the 14th Amendment says, that no state can deny the life, liberty, and property. And so by marriage being a fundamental right, then it would fall into one of those.
Yeah. The question is whether marriage is a right or a privilege. And even if it's a right, there can be limitations, say to underage marriage. You have to be an adult before you can get married. It's just like gun rights. There can be, even if guns are a right to have a gun, there are still the government can restrict it. If you're crazy and shot five people, you don't get to have a gun and so forth and so on.
And if marriage is to be regulated, who gets to do it? Is it the federal government or is it the states? Yeah, it's a fundamental question.
So that's going to the court. There are two marriage rights programs. I think that constitutionally it's not really settled whether marriage is a right or we all assume it's a right. And don't we? I mean, we assume we have a right to marry whoever we want to. I mean, just as a we think it's a right, but is it actually a right? And by according to the court,
it gets into the whole issue of religion too, because you know, is marriage a religious institution,
yeah,
or is it a legal institution? Is civil union a alternative, a equal alternative to marriage in a church?
You know, we have a couple of minutes. I think that's a really good question, Gary, because they tried civil unions. Remember, originally the president was against gay marriage. He was in favor of civil union, and it was a sort of what's turned out is a kind of separate but equal thing. It doesn't seem to work out to have gay folks to have civil unions and everybody else gets to have marriages. It's not really working out as separate but equal, because there's a lot of laws in terms of inheritance and stuff that don't apply to civil contract.
What a great non-segue into, we do have a couple organizations that help us out with this, Democrats of the Red Rocks. One of the things that makes Democrats of the Red Rocks door so cool is that they have movies every month at the library. And the movie this month is Wednesday, February 27th. It's called The Invisible War.
It's actually March 23rd.
It's actually March 23rd.
Yes.
Is that what, that's what, yeah. Yeah. It's not February 20th, it's March 23rd.
It's March 23rd. It's at the library. I think it's at 8 o'clock, Mike.
6
o'clock. was nominated. The movie was nominated for the Academy Award. We got our act together here. It didn't win last night.
But it's a cool movie anyway. Please go see it.
But it's about rape in the military, and there may be a speaker whose daughter was involved.
We want to say Democrats of the Verde Valley is hosting Fred Duvall, announced candidate for governor
Thursday
at Randall's Restaurant.
Thursday evening at 6:30.
You can
come meet Fred.
You can visit our podcast at vvid.org.
That's right. And find out what time the movie really is. No, it really is. Thanks to Democrats of Red Rocks, Democrats of the Verde Valley.
Everyone have a good day.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.